When listening to talks about raga dveshas, I often get confused about where the fine line between meeting your human needs and working on raga dveshas is. Example, to assimilate Vedanta and work on yourself, there may be adjustments to do in the practical life that will help getting self-knowledge. On the other hand, one needs to work on raga dveshas, accepting things as they are, and see everyday life as sadhana. For me, there can be conflict in the mind about wanting to relate more to other Vedanta students and then needing to say no to other relationships, which makes me feel more non-accepting. Or maybe it's me being too self-critical, not accepting my needs. Okay, well, there's some really, I think, important nuances there to understand just about raga dvesha in general. Raga means my likes, and dvesha means my dislikes. But to be more clear, a like is defined in this way. I want this so that I can be happy. That's a raga. A dvesha is I don't want this so that I can be happy, right? So what makes a like and dislike that we call raga dvesha, or another way of looking at that, is we call it a binding desire. It's a binding desire where what that means is if I don't fulfill the desire, I will really be unhappy. That my happiness, my fullness, my well-being really depends upon the fulfillment of that desire, either positively or negatively. I want this so that I can be happy. I don't want this so that I can be happy. That's the dvesha part. So it becomes a binding desire when my well-being is dependent on things going the way that I want them to, that desire is actually fulfilled. A non-binding desire is when I have, because we are, all your whole life you're going to have desires. It's just part of being a human being. It's also part of the karmas that caused you to take this very birth. Some of those karmas, so the unfoldment of your life will take place in you in the form of a desire. I want this, I need this, this is what I want to do. All of these desires are fine, they're healthy, they're normal. And I can't imagine actually being without any desire. Then what would even make me move at all? What would make me even breathe? I have to be hungry to go and eat, or, you know, I have to be thirsty to go and get a drink of water, or have to want something in order to pursue it. So desires are going to be there, but they need not be binding. Binding means if I don't get my way, I'll be really unhappy. And that is so painful. There's another way of being with my desires where I put all the energy into the desire that is justified for that particular pursuit. But I also realize that I may be the author of the pursuit, but I'm not the author of the result. Right? I'm not the giver of the result. Otherwise, we would always get what we want. You know, I'm going to do this so I can have that, period. If I do this, I will have that. But that's not the way it is. You know, we'll do what we can to achieve a given thing, but we may or may not get it because there's so many variables involved. And that's just simple reality that has to do with assimilation of experience, that understanding. And so, especially with Vedanta, it helps so much with this, but I'm just talking even on a secular level, realizing that really I'm not the giver of the fruits of my actions. I'm doing an action in order to get a particular result, but there's no certainty that I will actually get that. And so I have to have an orientation toward my desires that understands that reality. You know, the reality that I'll do what it takes to get that, but I may not get it. I'll make the proper, what I consider proper efforts, but I may not get it. Which means I have to be then living this life on a different level, where I do what I maintain my energy and I pursue my desires with an openness to not always get my way. That's just on a simple secular level. So the thing that I'm really pointing out here is this, that with or without knowledge, you will have desires. That's what keeps you moving. That's what keeps you making this choice as opposed to this choice, or going in this direction instead of in this direction. They say with the prarabdha karma, the karmas that caused you to take this birth, that will take you all the way through from birth to death, so that there's an unfoldment of your life that is taking place. And you are participating in that unfoldment. Sometimes you're participating in the unfoldment of your life through other people kind of dragging you into a situation. Because of their desire, they pull you into a situation that you find yourself in. Or sometimes the universe, just as the life unfolds, you find yourself in a situation, not because you desired it or somebody else desired it, but the universe has put you in the situation. And the third way is desires rise up inside of you to push you in a given direction. So that's how we participate in the universe, or how the universe structures our participation in our life. We're a participant in our life. We're moving within our life. We're drawn into it by other people. We're drawn into it through our own desires. We're drawn into it just by the situations that the universe gives us. So I think what is most realistic is to, from a Vedantic standpoint in a sense, to be open to the life that you have, because it's yours, this life you have. And the unfoldment of this life is there for you. Nothing will stop it. Like Swamiji used to say, "You, if it's yours, you'll get it. If it's not yours, you won't. So nothing to worry." Yeah. But I need to have a certain freedom, you know, to allow me to pursue my desires and at the same time have a different attitude which recognizes my ananda, my wholeness, is not really dependent upon the fulfillment of desires at all. This is a lot where the Vedanta comes in. And so say you have a strong desire, say mumukshu, you're a mumukshu, a jignyasu, somebody who desires liberation. You've recognized the limitations of the world. You realize there must be a way out in the sense, there must be a way for me to really be whole and complete, not in just these temporary glimpses, to be a whole and complete person. I've had glimpses of it. I know that I am that. I just can't hang on to it. There's something for me to know. There's something I have to understand. And I become somebody who really has a strong desire to know what is really going on and who I am. It's a very strong desire. And that desire can also be really a binding desire, causing you a lot of misery along the way when you're not getting your way or you really want to gain this knowledge and then obstacles are coming up. And those obstacles can cause a lot of pain because it's a binding desire. You know, so the desire for liberation, you know, it's a desire, it works just like a desire. It causes as much pain as other binding desires cause. The only difference is, which is a huge difference, is that this binding desire for liberation actually resolves the problem. It resolves the problem because it gives yourself the knowledge of really what the source of your ananda or wholeness is, where to get it, what it is, how that all works. It takes care of that problem. But the desire is so much, you know. I used to worry when I was in my 20s, I was at the, Swamiji was giving a course, 3 years, taught through all of the major texts in a three-year course. And when I started it, I used to worry about those 3 years coming to an end. You know, what am I going to do? I could hardly bear the thought of the three years down the road, this is going to come to an end, then what will happen? What will happen to me, you know? Or what if something happens to Swamiji? I used to have these kind of thoughts. Or Swamiji, you know, because we had classes every day. We'd have meditation, and then we'd have a morning class, usually an Upanishad, then a Sanskrit class. And then we'd have a 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock class, kind of like our schedule, a little more intense than our schedule, 5 o'clock class. Then we'd have a satsang. We'd do puja and all of that every single day. And then sometimes he would, in the first course, you know, he hardly ever went away. But when he did go away, say he had to go on a little trip for 1 or 2 days, that's all he would do at that time, only 1 or 2 days. We used to think, oh my gosh, he's going to be gone for 1 or 2 days. I'm not going to be having classes for 1 or 2 days. He'd be bummed out. You know, the binding desire, you know. But that binding desire is the only benign binding desire because it solves the problem by removing the self-ignorance so that the source of what you are seeking you recognize as being your very, the innermost self, your very being. You recognize Ishwara, you know what's going on, so the problem is taken care of. But in the meantime, you know, there's things that you really want that might make it better, make you get this knowledge faster and all of this. See, the best thing to do is, with this, these kind of desires around gaining knowledge, is to have faith in Ishwara. Because Ishwara is part of the promise of the Shruti, of the Upanishads themselves, that the mumukshu, when you're a mumukshu, you will meet your teacher, and what you need, you will get. Of course, sometimes what you get, you know, we get hard things because we get the things that we need for our mind to become mature, to work through our own likes and dislikes. We get Bhagawan, God kind of, Bhagawan for those who know Ishwara, you know, always gives you, you know, the greatest difficulties that you are able to handle at this time. Yeah. It's really, really something. You'll always find something. There'll always be something, you know, until you're just completely like Swamiji. Even then, Swamiji, I told some of you once that Swamiji said, maybe just a few years ago, things were really stressful as people have very needy, problematic people who there's a lot of pressure at the ashram in India that this needs to be done and that needs to be done and kind of different people having a lot of contention around all of these things. And Swamiji just went, and it was intense, all of this intensity going along, and everybody coming to Swamiji and just sort of creating their positions and all of this kind of stuff going on. And Swamiji was going in to eat in his little kutir, and he just said, you never compromise your vision. It's Advaita. it's just Advaita all the way. Don't give the slightest room for any of this. Just remember who you are. In so many words. Because I think Swami Vagishanand will say these kind of things too. You just don't go there. Don't go there. Just keep to your vision. Have shraddha and ishwara. Know yourself, you know. Own up your vision. And don't get pulled into all of the samsara that's very available to you. It's very available. You know, and Bhagavan makes sure that it's available. You know, and so you think that everything's fine and you're just riding along and oh, your mind is so sweet and mature and everything is so beautiful. And he'll go, well, let's try this one. Mm-hmm. So you go, oh, ah! Yeah. So you have to take all of that in good spirit so that your mind continues to mature as all of these, I call them zingers, are thrown your way. But that requires a lot, it requires shraddha. Shraddha means kind of Ishwara knows best, Bhagavan knows best, let him take care of me. You know, take care of me also includes putting me through all of these things that act as obstacles and make me, you know, upset or this or that. The fact that they make you upset means there's something that needs to be worked on there, you know. It is not that you won't have desires. It is not that you won't have preferences, you know. Like maybe you would rather, seems much more beneficial to be just with a group of mumukshus or a group of sadhus or people who are really intent on studying this vision. Wouldn't that be more conducive, you know, to my maturing than, you know, and to my gaining nishtha than being with all of these people that have no interest in it whatsoever? Why do I have to spend all of my time with that, you know? Well, spending all of your time with these type of people that maybe don't have the same set of desires or needs that you do may be just exactly what you need, you know? To learn how to be free and whole and complete in that situation. So you can just always, you know, thank Ishwara for all these problems that come our way. You know? Thank Ishwara for not making this into the Swargaloka that it isn't. Swargaloka means heaven, you know. Heaven, how they view heaven, as I desire it, so it comes, so no tension. It's limited amount of time that this lasts, but when I have a desire or something, there it is. No complaints. I think this would be good for me, okay, there it is. No, I think this would be good for me, okay, there it is. All right, no problem. But here it's not like that. I think this would be good for me, why aren't you giving it to me? Yeah. So that all has to do with assimilation of your knowledge and letting your mind become big and mature. And usually that maturing process is not something that we choose on our own because it's painful. If we're the areas where we're mature, it's not painful at all. We don't even notice. There's no problem, so we don't notice. It's just life going on. It's the areas where there's some raga dvesha, some binding desire you know, that creates a lot of pain. And when we were doing chapter 3 in Sweden, they went through that list, you know, of what happens when you have a desire. A desire, if it's fulfilled, no problem, fine. But the desire unfulfilled, it causes krodha. Krodha means different forms of anger and irritation and agitation. And then that itself can take you into Brahma, kind of a delusional state. You know, because then you're seeing everyone and everything through the eyes of this thwarted desire. And then it causes a loss of your buddhi, a loss of your knowledge. Your knowledge is thrown out the window, you know. And then you lose what is true to you as a human being, what you have as a human being, is that buddhi, that ability to do dharma, to follow dharma, to make appropriate choices. All of that's gone. All that's there is the rage, you know, and inappropriate behavior born of the rage caused by your unfulfilled desire. And so say you haven't had recently a strong desire, a binding desire. You know, I hope you get to have one. Because it actually happened to me a month or so ago, and I was so dumbfounded. I was so dumbfounded, but then I remembered the whole chapter 3, and this is exactly what Bhagavan said. You know, and it's like you have a binding desire. You didn't even know you had a binding desire. You have a binding desire. It's really important to you. And then it's thwarted. And then everything just goes berserk. It's a berserk inside because it's binding and it's thwarted. And then you get all of this worry and pain and, you know, angst, and these certain people become very enemies. And this whole, you become delusional, like a delusional mad person. Honestly, you just wait, you'll have another time. And then you can appreciate all that the Vedanta has so carefully laid out. You get to see it, you know, in 3D, like a movie, you know. So when it happened to me, I thought, oh, wow, boy, I am coming back to myself right now. So far away from yourself, and they just create nothing but havoc for yourself and other people. You know, it's when you need something in order for you to be happy. Mine, I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but I'll just give you a little hint. Mine had to do with my dogs. My love for my dogs, my relationship with my dogs. I thought, how could I get myself into a position like this? To have such strong feelings. And I had to really talk to myself about it. What is going on? And then I realized, you know, that ever since I was a little girl, I've always wanted my own dog. And finally that gets to happen. And then these obstructions start coming to stop me from having my little dog. It was really amazing. But I'm glad it happened to me, because I was able to outgrow that. And outgrow it pretty quickly. Because I don't want to suffer that kind of pain. So to answer the question about your raga dvesha, I think the best thing, you will always have desires, but to trust in Ishwara. You know, your desires will not always be fulfilled. Sometimes there's obstructions. You don't have control over the fulfillment of your desire. And if you're a mumukshu, there's a lot of pain around those obstructions. There can be. And I think that's mitigated the more you have Shraddha and Ishwara. Let Ishwara take care of it, you know. Because once you cross that line from being a samsari, somebody who's trying to make yourself happy and whole and complete by just fulfilling your desires in creation, once you cross that line, realizing that that's not going to work, and you actually become a mumukshu, then Bhagavan's responsible for you. It's his job. You will take care of it perfectly. That's what I truly believe that. My own experience with all my different resistances along the way. Sometimes they're really hard, but all necessary in order for you to really own up your knowledge. So I say, okay, Ishwara, you are so mean. You're so awful. But what happens to the knowledge for a person with Alzheimer's? What they say there is just, Alzheimer's is something that has taken place in the physical brain. And so that knowledge on every level is compromised. You know, what isn't compromised actually is kind of interesting, is that which cannot be compromised, which is your own being, the me. That self will never be compromised. But yourself is not talking or thinking either. You simply are. But what is compromised is all of the associations in the mind. You know, the mind can come very highly delusional. But what's interesting is you are still you. Your knowledge can become just terribly confused. You know, for some, I had Alzheimer's, and some of my family members who have since passed away. So I went through that with them, severe Alzheimer's. And it was so interesting. They were still, that me was still there, you know, but the whole reality, the world that they were living in was not the one I was living in at all anymore. And so the brain has gone through its modifications and is damaged and is not able to now any longer hold that knowledge in the brain. But in terms of the sukshma sharira, in terms of the subtle body, that knowledge has taken place already. So that ignorance is already removed. Just because the brain is not operable anymore, that doesn't mean that that ignorance hasn't been removed. It's just that this upadi, this body, mind, sense organs, is no longer a vehicle that's able to carry your knowledge or your ignorance or your anything. You can be living in a totally delusional world. You know what they say, maybe to help you understand this, is that, say, if you take a body, and you have a birth of a body, and that body is defective in some ways, like maybe a leg is missing or crippled, or maybe as you go along you're in an accident, like my friend who became a paraplegic. Different things can happen along the way where you're no longer able to walk, or maybe you're not able to talk, or you're not able to hear, or you're not able to see, you know, or the physical upadi, physical body is compromised can be in very extreme ways. But the subtle body is never compromised at all. It's just the subtle body that has taken this body is not able now to use this vehicle, because this vehicle has been damaged in one way or another. You know, so say if I lose an arm, the subtle body hasn't lost an arm. The physical body has lost an arm, so the subtle body can't make use of something that's not there. And so if the antakarana, if the mind, the buddhi, has lost the physical brain, then it's not able now to function, to use that physical instrument. But when the body dies, and this body drops off, and the subtle body is released from the physical body, then whatever knowledge was there, whoever you were, you know, before, is who you still are. You're no longer, you know, just like if you were blind, now you'll be able to see again, because the sukshma sharira has not been damaged. Physical body has been damaged. So you're not going to lose your knowledge or lose who you are or lose your capacities at all. But you will temporarily lose the expression of those capacities in this body that is no longer functioning as it should be. You know? And the brain is an organ, just like your eyes are, or your hands and legs. Any part of it can be damaged and become non-functional, including your brain. So kind of stick with it until the body dies. though just as an aside, they are finding something in Alzheimer's that's actually removing some sort of an enzyme or something. I just read about it. It's actually being able to remove the plaque that they say is causing the Alzheimer's. That has some really good, has some really positive prognosis. That they have to keep doing studies on it, but that's really interesting. So there's a plaque that's caused by a certain type of protein, and this particular enzyme or whatever it is able to dissolve that particular protein. And so in the trials, people have taken it, they have to have taken it for over a year. For all the, at 6 months you see a lot of plaque has been removed, but after a year there's actually cognitive restoration. So Alzheimer's, we're all afraid of that one. Nobody wants to get Alzheimer's. May you not get Alzheimer's. How are we to understand the reason for existence, karma, birth and death, etc., knowing that all that is consciousness? Why do we feel the need to follow Dharma and live with values and principles? You know, this is a really nice question. All the questions are nice, but each one has certain little important things in it. I need these. I didn't used to need these glasses. The key word here is reason, that there should be a reason, right? So how are we to understand the reason for existence, karma, birth and death, etc., knowing that all that is consciousness? Why is a reason necessary? Because if you say there should be a reason, who should have that reason? You know? Is it Bhagavan? That Bhagavan has a reason? Or that you have a reason? Or that there's a reason? What's the reason that the Bhagavan's there? You know? What's the reason that there is existence? Was there somebody making that decision, is the idea. Was there somebody making a decision that let us have now existence or being? Who would be making that decision prior to existence? Right? There can't be a reason. You're dealing with realities. And with realities, reason goes away. What I mean here is, well, let's look at it this way. Within duality, within time, there can be cause and effect, right? And we see that. In fact, our whole mind kind of works off of this idea of cause and effect. This happened because this happened, which happened because this happened, which happened because this happened. But now the thing is, if you take that cause and effect back to a beginning point, you can't get there. So any cause and effect relationship goes back into an infinite regress. The reason is, this is a little heady, I'm not going to spend much time in this, but just to understand, the cause and effect relationship will go into an infinite regress because it would have to end up in a first cause. And the first cause itself can't be caused, right? But if it can't be caused, it can't cause, right? It has to be free of cause and effect if it's a first cause. That means it itself has never come into being. If it's come into being, right, then it itself is an effect. So the cause-effect relationship, every cause is itself an effect by the prior cause. You see that? This cause creates this effect, and this effect creates this effect, etc. So it's cause effect, cause effect, cause effect, cause effect. So in any cause and effect sequence, you can never get to a first cause because the first cause is itself an effect. If the first cause is not an effect, right, then it's an uncaused cause, which has to be free of time, actually, because it's an uncaused cause. There can't be any change there. So within the creation, it's kind of like chicken and egg. Who came first, the chicken or the egg? Who came first, the mother or the child? Or the parents or the child? Again, that's a cause-effect relationship. The parent was themselves, were themselves children, right? And then those children, right, had parents who were themselves children. It goes back into infinite regress. And so even though we can kind of make some sense and create order out of the creation in terms of cause and effect, it's a very nebulous order, one that doesn't stand much inquiry. So now say we go to the nature of conscious being itself as unfolded in the Upanishads. Conscious being is itself free from time, and thereby free from change. It's free from objectification. And so for the self, there is no reason, because there's no prior condition. There's nobody there to say, oh, let's have a non-dual, changeless conscious being. There's nobody there to say that. And so once you're into the world of the timeless, and that which is non-objectifiable, non-spatial, non-bound by time, you just have being itself. So being itself is a reality. It is what is. It has no reason because there's no prior condition. There's nobody to give it a reason, right? It is its own reason without being a reason. It just simply is. And then say we look at Ishwara or Maya. This might be over the heads for a little bit. Like come for. Don't worry about it if it is. This Maya, which is responsible for the kind of cyclical projection, sustenance, and resolution of the creation, the Shastra, the Upanishads will say, this Maya is itself beginningless. It's cyclical, but it's beginningless. So this creation is viewed as something that projects and resolves and projects and resolves from beginningless time. Beginningless time means there's no one there to create it. And if there was somebody there to create all of this, what did they use to create it? Because this itself is the creation. So what was there prior to this to use to create this? See what I mean? They say this is not created. It's something which is beginningless. And once you say beginningless, again, there's no reason because there's no first cause. There's nobody there to decide. Let's do this. You can't decide because this is already there. See? So now the whole idea of reason in reference to me, to conscious being, and in reference to Ishwara, means the Ishwara as God, the whole creation as a expression of conscious being. You can say, why did Ishwara do it like this? He could have done a better job. So that we're all born enlightened. And there is no problem at all. He made all these problems. Yeah. But Ishwara didn't do anything. Ishwara simply is. Ishwara might as well say, why am I like this? You know? But as an infinite being, he's not going to say, why am I like this? He's not going to say anything, right? But the point is that Ishwara is what Ishwara is. The self is what the self is. There's not this cause-effect sequence, an applicable cause-effect sequence, once you get beyond time, or once you get to beginninglessness. So within time, we can find cause-effect rifts that help us in order to accomplish things in the world, and science becomes useful. But even science or accomplishments in the world, if you take the cause and effect back far enough, you'll reach an infinite regress, and you just have to basically let it go. Right. So those kind of, you know, the search for reason is a search that you end up letting it go of, not because, oh, I guess the Vedanta can't answer that question. It's not that. It's not that the Upanishads don't answer the question. It's that the question itself is totally irrelevant. what is time, what is free from time, cannot have a reason. Because there's nobody there to give it a reason, right? What is beginningless, there's nobody there to say, why did you do it like that? Because that is the nature of the thing. So there's no decision being made, there's just the reality of what is, okay, once you're beyond time. So now, how are we to understand the reason for existence, karma, birth and death, etc.? Okay, so we would say for the jiva, for this one who takes birth after birth after birth from beginningless time, you have an infinite regress into endless births and deaths. There's no first birth for you. But you have accrued in this beginningless birth and death sequence limitless karmas. Means karmas that will fructify into your next birth. I'll get into a much more detailed explanation of karma later, so you understand all the ins and outs of karma. But the karmas that cause you to take this birth were accrued in previous births, and at the time of your death, of your last life, you would have attracted that from that infinite supply of karmas, karmas that were appropriate, you know, actions that will be fructified later, actions that are appropriate, karmas that are appropriate for you at this time of death. Just like you could say, if you just look at your life here, here's today and tomorrow and next month and next year, you are attracting to yourself the karmas and the situations that match who you are, you know? And like that, when you go to the next life, you'll be attracting from your storehouse of karmas the situations that will be conducive to the person who is passing from this life into the next. So it's just a cause and in a sense, a cause-effect sequence where the karmas that you're attracting are the karmas that are a fit for you in this next life that you take. So there's an orderly series of experiences that goes from birth to death, from birth to death, from birth to death. Even if you look at this life, you can make sense of your life. This happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And you can see also a lot of things that were meaningful. You know, that seems meaningful how all of these things happened. In hindsight, we can often see that. So you can see the flow of your life. And then say if you were able to be from a more subtle plane, when you leave this body, sometimes they say you can see the whole many, many births. Like there, I had this day, this life, and this life, and this life, and this life, and it all is kind of a sequence. You know, it's just you get to see a much longer sequence than you do in a given birth, where you only see the sequence of your life from birth to death. They say when you leave this body, you can see from that more subtle plane a much longer sequence, so they say. And so why are things that way? Because that's how they are. there's no one to decide, because it's the structure of the creation. It's beginningless. You say that all this, when we recognize that all of this is consciousness, why do we even need to recognize that? Why do we need to recognize who we are? We need to recognize it because of pain. If we didn't have any pain, we wouldn't care, everything would be fine. But we have pain, you know, and we feel alienated from ourselves. We feel alienated from the creation, alienated from others, alienated from God, you know. And those periods of alienation or isolation are really painful because they don't match me. They're not who I am, you know. And so I feel isolated from myself, and I want to get home. I want to get home to myself, to who I am. Now this thing about Dharma, the need to follow Dharma, you know, I think we have a need to follow Dharma because dharma is what is natural to us. That is our natural behavior. And when you're outside of dharma, in terms of your behavior, that doing to others as I would have done to myself, all this golden rule, that kindness or love or compassion or care, or all these kind of positive spectrum of emotions and relationship toward others, that's who we are. We're not acting that way when we're in pain. But, you know, when we're in pain or we have anger or something is thwarted inside, then we don't follow dharma. We can be angry, we can be unkind, we can be mean, all of these things. But that's all of that type of behavior is coming out of our own hurt, our own sense of isolation. When you're just with yourself, then that, you know, care and caring about others and being helpful, that's who you are. And you feel, that's why when you're that way, you feel so comfortable. Everything's fine, you know, because it's a natural expression for you. And when you're expressing the opposite, you feel very uncomfortable, you know, and very bad. You feel so badly, even if sometimes you blow off steam because you can't stand the pressure of some anger that you're holding. You blow off the steam, then you feel terrible and isolated, you know. But all of those negative spectrum, they're just expressions of pain. They're expressions of thwarted desire, really. You know, in some way I'm not getting my way. And that creates this anger and tension and all these things and makes me act in a way that is not natural to myself. And so even without knowledge, without self-knowledge, as you assimilate your experience, you become more and more, gravitate more and more toward dharma. Because I feel good. You know, it makes me feel whole and complete. And I would rather give up some of these sensory pleasures and feel whole and complete than feel kind of isolated inside and have some sensory pleasure. But there's no comparison. So what we say, and the Shastra will say, is have your sensory pleasures, but always have them within dharma. Never sacrifice dharma for some sort of pleasure. It's so not worth it. The pleasure is just so short-lived, and the pain of the adharma is long-lived. So you have the long-lived pain of the adharma in this little bleep of pleasure. You know, it's like putting a little band-aid or something on a big wound. So it doesn't help. Taking some aspirin or some drug or something, try to cover up the adharma that's hurting you. So always learn to choose dharma over adharma, just by life experience, assimilation of experience. Okay, so we're just going to do one more. We have two there, we're going to do one, and then do a couple of bhajans, okay? And maybe not this one if it's too hard. Oh, let me see. What is the definition of space? The concept of space between two things seems to limit space. So how do we understand what it means in the context of Vedanta? Tomorrow. And the reason I can do like a one sentence answer or something like that, but actually space is one of the five elements and it's the most subtle of the elements. It's actually an important question. And so I'll work on a little bit more tomorrow so I can give it a better answer. Okay. Let's do it. Swasti. So others of you who can sing bhajans, you have checked this heard too. So we can have other people do it. But for now. Okay.
Chittukhabhavet asato ma satkamaya.